Cash rules everything around me. Cream with the money, dollar dollar bill, y'all. Wu-Tang said it best, cash does rule everything around us. I'm John Gabris, and welcome back to another episode of The Layman. Today, we're going to learn about cheddar, dollars, clams, bucks, money, currency, all that crap, all this grown-up money stuff. It's so important, but I am so uninformed. I mean, a lot of America is uninformed, but I am truly uninformed. I didn't even know credit card debt was bad until I had $30,000 of it. I'm still in credit card debt, and I'm on television. This is the kind of shit I'm dealing with. I'm really trying to get better. I want to save up. I want to buy a house. I want to have a cool Woody station wagon with surfboards on top of it. So I'm doing anything I can to get better with money, to learn more about finances, and specifically, why am I such an epic fuck-up when it comes to finances? Is it in my genes? Is it biology? Is it psychology? Is it my parents' fault? Please, let it be my parents' fault. Need more stuff to blame on my parents. So that's why I went to the USC campus to speak with Dr. Cary Friedman. He's a neuroeconomist, which means he knows about brains and money. Two things I have zero of, but aspire to have more of. He's definitely the man to get some answers to the critical question, what's wrong with me? Also, I feel like maybe I should just add a disclaimer just in case you guys are getting your financial advice from a podcast about an idiot learning more about science. Don't do what I do. Get a financial advisor. I think that's a thing. Or talk to a parent. Just talk to your parents. Speak to your parents more. Call your mother. All right, let's get to the interview.
Cary, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I get the awesome view out your window of Trojan Stadium. If that isn't a clue enough, we're on the USC campus where you are a professor. So let's talk a little bit about this, Cary. What do you teach here at USC, or what's your field? How do you scientists even describe each other, or how do you describe yourself?
Yeah, so I teach intro to finance. And so what I'm doing, and there it's kind of interesting. We talk about just the super basics of, you know, what people should do when they're making investment decisions. But what I do in my research is see whether people actually do what we teach them to do, or what we do, what they say we should do.
And why.
And it, yeah, exactly.
And
why.
Yeah.
And it turns out that's not always the case. We actually find some mismatch between what we teach and what's actually going on in the world.
You're telling me despite people knowing what they should be doing with their money, they don't always make decisions?
That's right. And despite people listening to what I say, they still don't act upon
direct advice from someone who's dedicated their life studying to this. They still don't. Trust me, I can carry credit card debt.
That's right. That's right. So it's kind of subordination in its kind of extreme form.
That's funny for you to look at it as like they're just not listening to me.
Right. They need to take a time out, basically. So the way I do these studies is I'll have people come inside a lab, and then I'll have them trade while they're basically having their brain scanned.
Oh, so like in movies, you'll put those like nodes on
their
head.
Yeah. Oh. So that's
everything. By the way, any understanding I have of science comes from movies.
Okay,
so
good.
Help me.
I would say kind of half of that is true for me as well. So we have something in common,
with the exception of my doctorate.
Exactly.
Other than that, I learned everything else
exactly
from movies.
From movies. So what I do is I use a method called fMRI, which is functional magnetic resonance imaging. So it's not putting the electrodes directly on the scalp, which is something called EEG. I think that's what...
Electroencephalogram?
You know your movies.
Yes.
And so...
I have two nurses in my family, so
okay.
I know what an MRI and an EEG
is from that.
Yeah.
Good. So then while they're inside this MRI, this fMRI, they're trading. And so I basically get to see two really cool things. One is what they're actually trading. So they're kind of stock and, you know, buying and selling decisions. But then on top of that, I also see what's going on inside the brain. So I'm able to see kind of proxies of the neural activity in the brain. And so what I'll try to do then is use that extra data to really understand what's driving these decisions, which kind of don't accord with what would be kind of the traditional or rational paradigm in finance.
Full disclosure at this point, I have like $8,000 in savings,
okay,
and it's just in like a 0.05% online account. I have no investments except for my wife's 401k, which we started a year ago.
Okay.
So I am like completely rookie in this field. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I won't spend time giving investment advice because I feel a little weird about that.
This podcast completely changes. I'm like, hey, can you just look at this? I owe American Express this much. Can you help?
Off mic, here's my finances, basically.
I leave.
Yeah.
Thank you, Cary.
Yeah.
This has been a great podcast
for me. Send me an email. Right. So actually that point about buying low, selling high is kind of what I'm saying now. And the reason I say it's maybe not the best thing is intuitively it sounds right, right? You buy something at, let's say, 50, you sell it at 100, you've made money. Excellent. Yeah. But the idea is that if you sell it at 100, you may have actually sold it too early.
Right. Could go to 150.
Could go to 150. And there are certain patterns in the market that people have kind of uncovered, which show that, you know, if something's gone up recently, it might actually tend to go up a little bit more. But people are kind of so, they want this kick of selling something that they've made money on because it kind of makes them feel good. They get this kind of kick.
And that's what you're studying. And
yeah, exactly.
Potentially to combat that, to want to like blow past that kick, right?
Right. So
to kind of take the emotions out of a trading.
Yeah. So the first thing we wanted to do was document that there is this kick because, I mean, to me, intuitively, yeah, it makes sense. And I think to kind of most people, it makes sense. But within kind of the standard research in finance, it's kind of a unorthodox assumption that people actually get this kick of happiness or this emotion is generated from selling something at a gain.
Up until recently, people didn't look at the neural, what was going on inside the brain in reaction to these.
That's right. Events. That's right. Yeah. Because, I mean, one reason is just the technology wasn't there. And now that we have the technology, we can provide kind of hard data showing that we, you know, that people maybe do get this kind of kick from trading. And that is what we found out. And so just following on your next point, what I'm doing now is trying to see whether we can mitigate that or kind of reduce that, not just because I want to make people numb and not have any emotions.
That's a secondary effect.
Right. That's what I do. That's what I do when I teach. But what we're trying to do is kind of mute that emotion if it reduces trading performance.
And right. So, well, taking the emotion out of a lot of things in life would make them easier to, like, I don't know much about finances, but I know about gambling. I'm a longtime gambler.
They're quite interrelated.
Yeah. If you can remove emotions from playing poker, you do better.
Yeah.
If you're not like, oh, like if you lose the fact like, oh, this is a lucky hand. Yeah. Oh, I'm feeling good about this. Yeah. That's not how it works. There's probability. Like,
right. Yeah. Right. But I think, I think emotions are still useful in most contexts. I mean, there are certain cases, maybe in finance or gambling, where you want to kind of purge them a little bit.
Right.
But
maybe in like relationships and social interactions.
Yeah, social interactions, you want to have a little bit of emotion. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just...
But not too much. We're talking to scientists.
Yeah, yeah. This is. Let's not go overboard here.
So have you, I don't know how far along you are in your study, have you proven that there is an emotional kick or at least points to that?
So the data, so far the data is showing or it's suggesting that there is this kick from selling at a gain. And so what we're trying to do now is design basically financial platforms or software, which would maybe display the information in a different manner such that it's maybe harder to generate that emotion. And so let me unpack that for 1 second. So what I mean by that is, in order to sell something at a gain, you have to know that it's at a gain.
Right.
Right. And so what we do, what we're playing with is basically a new type of trading platform where you just don't show them the price at which they purchased the stock.
Oh.
And then.
So if you never know, you're like, oh, did I make $2 or $8?
Exactly.
Well, either way, I feel like this is going to keep going up. So I'd hold out.
Right. Right. Wow. So you just make it harder for them to kind of feel like a king, you know, right, for making a gain. And so what we've seen so far is that when you just remove that information, this effect goes down and actually they make more money.
It's funny that you say that to like hide that from them, because I know if you read any financial advice or when you think about how, when you talk to friends like, oh, how do you save money? How do you do this?
Yeah.
A lot of them involve like tricking yourself.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of people I know are like, if you put away $1 on first week and $2 the second week and all the way up to $52, it never feels like much, but it's this. If you take it out pre-tax, if you automatically withdraw into savings, it's all that stuff that's like alerting, like not letting you feel a certain thing. Like you have to kind of like hide your own smart decisions from yourself.
That's right. Yeah. So I think this idea of self-control is like a huge part of finance, which traditionally has not been studied in it.
Right.
I mean, maybe like 30 years ago, there was, you know, when this kind of field of behavioral finance was just starting out, there was this paper that came out suggesting that self-control was a huge issue in finance, and it really didn't take off. And to me, it was kind of strange because, you know, intuitively, it seems like self-control is a huge issue in finance because people are making the decisions, and every person that I know, at least, has huge self-control issues.
Every person I've ever met has made at least one bad decision at some point in their lives.
Yes.
Self-control, I know this is a radio, this is an audio show, but if you can't, I look like the bastion of no self-control. I am unkempt. I am unhealthy. I can't control myself.
I think you look great.
Hey, thank you. Yeah. All right. True mission of the podcast accomplished. Okay. I just need intelligent people to tell me I look great. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Wrap it up. We're done here.
All right. See you later.
Perfect. Ego stroked. Yeah. Moving on. Yeah. You can check the EMRIs that are attached to my head.
You are getting
FMRI.
A lot. FMRIs.
Oh, damn. Yeah. Do you find that there is any emotional response or any emotional backing to like letting it ride or like not taking it out, like wishful thinking or hoping? Is that are you able to track that too? Like kind of the opposite of what we just.
So something a little bit related that I've been working on now as well is this idea that people just keep expecting trends to continue. So the idea that if you've had, you know, good luck with a stock that's gone up several times in a row. Then you extrapolate that this thing is going to keep on going up.
Yeah, that there's no end to that.
Yeah, but the interesting thing to me is that, you know, a lot of the data suggests that it's not predictable, meaning that a lot of the stuff we deal with is just completely random.
Right, it's like the people who, if you flip heads five times on
they
a penny,
it'll be a tail.
It's got a tail. You're due for a tail.
Right, yeah. So just go
impossible.
To Vegas and the roulette wheel.
Right,
and there's
it's been
be
all
bunch.
Black for a while.
Right,
it's
got to
be
red. Yeah. So that's a kind of very... very strong bias that I think is definitely relevant for finance. So people in finance, they call that just this gambler's fallacy. So it's a fallacy that the gambler believes that, you know, these stimuli, which in the case of the casino is just a bunch of red numbers, is going to turn black. But the case is that it's going to be the same chance of black or red on every trial.
Right, right.
This
solar power company you're investing in happens to be going up, but that doesn't mean that you can extrapolate, like it's not like the equation goes, and it will continue to rise, or else everyone would just be
right. Right, yeah. But the thing I'm studying, or the angle I'm taking on this stuff is, well, why are we so kind of prone to this type of bias? And it turns out, so far, what we found a little bit is that our perception and kind of our vision is so attuned, it's designed basically to pick up patterns.
I know a little bit about patterns from doing improv, and it's like, that's why we like music. That's why we like certain design.
That's right.
Because it's soothing to see a pattern.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, when something is unusual, you recognize it because it breaks the pattern
that's
of your
exactly
normal
right.
day.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So people have shown that if you show like, you know, four heads in a row, then on the fifth one, if it's a tail, there's this huge activity in let's say, the prefrontal cortex of the brain because it's this surprise. And what it suggests is that, you know, the brain is perceiving as a surprise, which means that you can infer that the person was expecting something else.
Right, because a surprise means not meeting expectations.
Exactly.
Cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
So even if your brain, if you're a logical enough guy to know, or person to know that it's a 50-50, you're still like, I bet you it's another head.
That's
though.
Right.
We're on a head streak.
Because
right
it's just, it's kind of... you know, hardwire is maybe not a technical term, but it's kind of ingrained
right.
that we have this pattern detection mechanism. And I think what's happened is that it was useful many, many, you know, millions of years ago, but now that we're
right.
doing
every time I touch fire, my hand hurts.
Yeah.
Okay. We should stop touching
no,
fire.
No. Yeah. My friend was telling me something similar that you shouldn't touch fire. No, but
My friend, he's a scientist. He's on year 9 of studying why you shouldn't touch fire.
Yeah, he says
he's draining USC of their research dollars.
He says it's hot.
He says it's hot. I'll wait and make my own judgment.
Yeah. But so, you know, just to follow up on that perception point. So I think, you know, at this point, we just, it's so ingrained in the brain and people just kind of inherit that, you know, when they're looking at other types of stimulus like the stock market or something like that.
Yeah, and they would be surprised when it dropped.
Exactly, exactly.
Let's get into a couple of just more general questions because I'm very interested. What made you choose this field in particular? Were you an economics guy who got into the science of it? Were you a science guy who got into the economics of it? Or is it just a nice dovetail of
things? So it was the first way. So I came into, in college I was an economics and math major and I came to Caltech to do a PhD, and I wanted to just kind of keep going down this very theoretical path that I was interested in college. But then when I got to Caltech, this was like 2008, kind of when there was that big crisis in finance that everyone kind of heard about. there was also this really kind of explosion of research at Caltech on this intersection of neuroscience and economics. And I kind of found myself in, I guess, kind of the right place at the right time because I was just blown away by how exciting this stuff was and the potential for what could be explored both you know, on the neuroscience side and also on the economics side.
That is interesting. Like I took an economics course. When you think about it, there's no ever really explained why to any, like, and
right.
That's what, like, why we make these decisions.
That's right. That's right.
Why people in general make those decisions.
Yeah. So, I mean, one really nice thing about the way that economics works is that it's extremely rigorous, and you have these assumptions about how people act. And then from that, you could figure out, you can make these large scale predictions about what should happen in society and, you know, how people should invest and save. But you're exactly right that one thing that maybe isn't that kind of was lagging behind a little bit these assumptions was testing them, was seeing, do people actually behave in this type of way?
Yeah, because there were like large assumptions, like people are generally blank when it comes to
exactly
saving. Yeah,
exactly.
And so we're like, why are they, and are they actually? And,
right.
Oh, that's really cool.
And so, yeah, so there was these very strong assumptions that people always, what's called, maximize their utility. So they'll you know, always be consistent, they'll always be rational. But there's been a lot of data over the last, let's say, 30 years showing that people don't always act in accordance with these assumptions. And they depart from them in systematic ways. And so what you could do with this neuroscience stuff,
you can find a pattern in the way people depart from what we think are the norms.
That, right. And that should then be the new assumption.
That's the new norm.
Yes. Right. Right. And then once you have that, then you could start making more realistic predictions. And, you know, hopefully even better policy and stuff like this.
We're talking pretty high concept here, but is there an example you could give of, like, we made these basic assumptions to people, it turns out they break the assumption in this way?
Right. Is, yeah. So we could go back to maybe even the buy low, sell high stuff, or maybe something, another example would be this idea of regret, where people, when they buy something and then they later sell it. So let's say they buy low, sell high, but then what they'll do is they'll continue to follow
and see if it, it's,
and
still
see, goes up or, yeah, goes down. But
to retroactively make them feel good about their,
right,
decision.
But
they're hoping so you're rooting for it to go down.
You're rooting for it to go down. Exactly.
Which makes also no sense.
Right. Because you don't hold it anymore. But
right,
like,
it doesn't affect you if,
yeah,
it goes
you
down.
Continue, like, you know, opening up Yahoo Finance and, you know, clicking on Microsoft and seeing whether or not actually went down after you sold. And so, but the interesting, so we're studying this in the brain scanner too. And what you could see is that after they sold, but it keeps going up, you could see this decrease in brain activity, which represents kind of like a regret signal. And then the interesting thing is that the people, there's kind of different strengths of this regret signal. And so some people are extremely prone to feeling regret after they will sell something and then it goes down. And those are the people that will not buy it back, even if they should.
Oh, and that's probably a big step too, is because then you have to kind of admit your own fault, and that, which is hard for a lot of people.
That's right.
At least anecdotally, I can assume that people have a hard time admitting they're wrong.
That's right.
And then that makes total sense, because it would not benefit you or anyone, but you would be, it's like FOMO. It's like you're missing out.
Exactly.
You're missing out on it doing well, so you'd rather it do bad. It's like breaking up with a girl and then hoping she doesn't meet anyone else. Because you don't want to date her, but you don't want her to have a better,
right,
life than you.
That's
either,
right. So,
which is awful, but
exactly,
it's a true emotion we have.
Right. Like, yeah. So, yeah. So instead of maybe looking on Yahoo Finance, you look on Facebook.
Yeah.
Right?
That's, yeah. Well, that's what people genuinely do to make sure that their exes are doing worse,
that's
than,
right,
they are.
That's right. Yeah. And if they happen to be doing better, then you just feel this kind of pang of regret.
Oh, that, like, I never thought about it like that. So you would be, like, if you sold your Apple stock, you'd be actively rooting for it to do worse so that you feel vindicated,
right,
in your decision,
right,
which is insane.
Maybe insane or irrational.
Not insane, sorry, irrational.
Yeah.
Insane,
I don't know. I guess you could use the word insane.
That's just hyperbole from a non-scientist. Like, technically, you can't use the term insane because it means something.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's fucking wild, man.
But yeah, you're exactly right. So this, it turns out that it's exactly the wrong thing to do, right? Because if it actually goes up after you sold it, then what you should do is buy it back.
Yeah, because even if you're like, bummer, I missed out on that jump. But if it jumps again, then you're fine by getting,
right,
buying back. And yes, maybe if you didn't sell it, you would be doing even better. But why not get a little more out of it?
Exactly. And yeah, the kind of perverse thing is that by missing out on that jump, it actually will signal that it's a kind of higher likelihood chance that it's going to jump again.
Right.
And so this is the same idea that a lot of people in marketing talk about. So if you find something on sale and then you don't buy it, but then, you know, you go back to the store again, they've raised the price a little bit, you should still buy it because it's technically on sale. But you don't do it. You have this thing like, called...
Oh, bummer. I missed... I'm not paying an extra dollar. I could have got it yesterday for five.
Even though you still value it much more than it currently is priced at.
Exactly. You would... You could pay up to 10 for it. It's now six. And you're like, I missed it on five. Now I won't get it.
That's right. So that's...
like the little kid, fold your arms.
No, right.
Now
right.
I don't want anything.
I need to put that little dude in an illustration at the top of the paper now, actually. And in fact, I could maybe take a photo of you doing that.
You want me to? Yeah, that would be great. That'd be great. I'll make this face, the frowny, like, man, when I know that I want to go to my friend's house. You're not allowed to go until four. This is all right, but you can go at four. I'm like, no, now I don't want to go at all out of some weird spite to prove some point to you, but I'm actively choosing to miss out on going
that's
to my
right.
friend's
house. That's right. I think it's like a sour grapes type thing.
Yeah.
You kind of devalue this thing that you really like just because you can't have it.
Oh, that is so... Well, and you see that in so many interactions, not to keep bringing it back to high school romance, but if you like a girl or a person and it's unrequited, you start to paint them negatively
right.
in your head.
You start looking for faults.
Yeah, like, I didn't want to go... Who wants to date a smoker anyway? Right. You know, all of a sudden you're just like knocking her down a peg or two when you just moments ago would have professed your love to her.
Exactly.
That's so the things we do to ourselves to make ourselves always feel like we made the right decision is
I think it's a huge part that people haven't explored yet. This idea of just dissonance, cognitive dissonance. And so I have a friend, a colleague down the hall who's studying this and kind of looking at how this cognitive dissonance will affect your trading behavior. And it's there's just very, very strong effects.
That's wild to think, because a lot of people don't do their own trading, hire someone to do their trading. You don't even know what that person's going through emotionally or
that's
logically
right.
and stuff.
But I think the interesting thing is, and again, this is what a few colleagues down the hall have just pointed out, is that if you hire someone, then if they do something poorly, you can blame it on them, right?
Yeah.
Then you don't have to blame it on your own self.
Right.
And then,
if they do something good?
Yeah, then you attribute, you know, their good
you
skill.
You delegated.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, I really know how to pick the right guy.
I picked the right guy,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
That is classic human behavior.
Yes.
I'll be around when the good credit needs to be taken.
Oh, somebody won? Where's my share?
Now, by design of hiring someone else to take care of your money, you are putting taking one layer of emotion out of it because you're not looking at your actual... That's why a lot of people like those mutual funds or 401ks, because you kind of can, it's like set it and forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, I just trust that they're doing the right things with my money in there.
That's right. Yeah. I think that might be one reason people do that. They delegate or they just invest in a fund and don't look again. And actually, that's the advice that I think a lot of people give is just most people can't kind of consistently and actively beat the market, so you might as well just put something away and just kind of let it sit and kind of accrue.
You're saying buy gold bars.
Yes. You need to rush out and take the money under your mattress and then
buy commemorative gold bars off of any infomercial you see. You will.
Yes.
It'll be worth it in the
long
run.
We actually are selling some, so if you would like to buy... USC is happy to take.
You're like getting a weird cut.
Yeah.
What was like the most intense or weirdest course like that you had to take in your...
I mean, I guess just going back, probably in my first year in grad school, we had this class just on analytical foundations of decision theory. So we want to just take a break and then we'll come back in a second.
Yeah, I want to take a break while I try to write that down,
yeah.
Try to spell it.
Exactly.
Analytical decisions of...
I think analytical foundations of decision theory.
Okay.
So it was just this super heavy class on just pure math, trying to understand and trying to model economic decisions.
Oof.
And this was first semester that I moved to California. and I was like, what just happened in life?
A little different than most people's moving to California stories.
You're like,
I'm going to California, I'm going to go to the beach. Me, I'm doing analytical foundations of decision theory.
That's right. Yeah, so I actually never thought about that. Like, I tell all my friends, I'm moving to the West Coast. It's going to be a pretty
they're
sweet
like, oh,
life.
Oh, sick, man. Yeah, bikinis, surfing. You're like, sort of. I'll be at Caltech. Wait, where'd you go?
Yeah, it was Caltech. Oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah, I took classes based on how many movies you got to watch in the classroom. So... We had a different history. I just want to ask you a couple of questions about, like, if you can help me unpack, like, what's going on in Britain. Like, for example, just something I notice is that, like, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to buy that. That's $8.
Mm.
Oh, $9? That's a ripoff.
Mm.
But then I'll, like, go to a bar and have three $12 cocktails. And I know alcohol is obviously loosens up decisions making.
Yeah.
But I find that it weirdly depends on the world of the money that like like what I'm spending on, that numbers vary differently for me.
Right. Yeah. Well,
I'll go to a casino and lose a couple hundred dollars playing craps and be like, I'm a couple hundred dollars down. And then I'll go from the casino to a casino bar and they're like, it's $8 for a Bud Light. And I'll be like, this is a ripoff.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, I just lost $500. What's eight more?
Right, right, right.
And what's going on? I mean,
yeah. What's
wrong with me? Yeah. By the way, for the listeners, I'm lying on a leather couch. I'm not that kind of doctor, is what Carrie keeps repeating to me.
Yeah, that is a good question. What's going on? So I think maybe the first order effect, you know, with the casino example is, are you getting comped while you're playing?
Right. Well, that's the other thing too. You can get the logic at a casino when you lose $500, but you had three free beers.
Right.
It's like you're netting $496.
Yeah. Really, really high roar there. Really getting those free comps.
But it's weird how you won't pay for a drink if you could get one for free while losing.
That's
a shit
right.
Ton of
that's
money.
Right. So I think, I mean, the thing that it sounds kind of like is this idea that we kind of group our spending into kind of different mental accounts. And so this kind of one episode that you're having at the table is saying, okay, I'm going to start with whatever, $500, and then just see what I can do. And, you know, presumably, well, maybe not presumably, but supposedly you end up without anything left. You've lost, you know, you've lost your shirt and maybe more.
Common to have. I don't know much about science, but you do lose often in casinos. Yes.
So you lose $500 and then you go to the bar. And then I think what happens in your mind is you kind of, you've closed this account in your mind when you kind of got up from the table with no chips, even though you sat down with $500 worth of chips.
Right.
And then you're kind of at this zero reference point when you go to the bar. And then when you're paying for that $8 drink, all of a sudden your entire range, your kind of world of perception is now narrowed down just in between this range of, let's say, $0 and $20.
Right, right.
So you're normalizing this kind of range that you have in your mind, and you just think of them as two completely different episodes. And this I think will generate this type of weird, you know, from what I'm getting from you sitting on this leather couch, is that you know, you just find it very bizarre.
When did you get a pipe?
I also grew elbow patches. It's this idea that things are extremely context dependent, I think.
Right. That totally, like, I can see it with like my wife's spending, where it's like, if it's for her like standard maintenance products, which is all stuff that's super expensive, it's one thing. But I'm like, hey, we should do this. She's like, I don't know, it costs this much, you know, like, it's just kind of weird, whatever your frame of reference is. Have you studied, like, I guess day trading is gambling in a way, there is some science behind it, but I'm so into gambling, I'm always curious about the I would love to know about the neurological things behind gambling. Like, like you said, like, is it going to keep going up? People sell remorse. Like, that's the same thing as like stepping away from the table while you're up. It's like, but I could be more up.
It's a
matter of realizing when the streak is over. But a streak isn't a scientifically proven thing in gambling.
Right. Yeah. I think it's pretty tough to show evidence of a real streak in in gambling. But
there is some psychology behind that.
Yeah. Definitely people perceive them as being streaks. And the more you perceive it, maybe the higher the likelihood you stick around. But I think, you know, to get at your question about the neurological, you know, components behind this stuff, people have done a lot of really interesting work in studying this, and it's this idea that you get this kick, or you get this...
It's like a true dopamine release,
right, when you win, and it kind of gets dampened as you keep winning. And so this kind of might be an underlying foundation of addiction. And so people that are addicted to maybe, you know, one stimulus, let's call it a drug, may also be addicted to something like gambling. And you know, that's, I think, a product of many things. One is the environment, but it's also genetic. So I've done a little bit of work on this genetics of gambling, actually.
I come from a long line of gamblers, to be honest. My mom goes to Atlantic City twice a month. My grandpa went every month for his whole life from like 20 to 70.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I always thought it was just cultural that like my family gambled, so I gambled as I got older. Yeah. But if there's genetics behind
it. It could. I think that there definitely is, but I also think you're right that it could be cultural, because it's really hard to disentangle those two.
Going back to gambling for a second, because there is something like, if you win $20 on a scratch-off, the feeling you get is so different than if you were to work a job for 1 hour that paid $50. Like, if you did a gig that you did a gig for 1 hour and you got paid $50, or just let's just make it $20 just to keep it even. You got paid $20 for a job, you'd be like, cool, $20. But if you scratch something off and win $20, the feeling is different.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Is that just because it's a quick buck sort of free money mentality? Even if you spent $20 on scratch offs and won $20, right, you'd still feel like,
yeah, that's interesting. I think there's two things going on there. One is, first of all, I mean, with the quick win, you just get the reward without any work.
And right. So you don't have to do that.
You get this surplus. And that surplus, I think, is just kind of a kick in your mind. And that, I think, is rational, right? It's this unexpected windfall.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're just super happy. Whereas, you know, if you get this paycheck after you do the gig, you're like, well, you know.
Yeah, that's what was supposed to happen.
Yeah, that was supposed to happen. You get that kind of like, you know, meh face that you were doing before. yeah, exactly. but I also think that, yeah, there is this just kind of euphoric kick of just winning, you know.
That's how the Publishers Clearinghouse got people for so long.
Like, right.
You may be a winner, and that was enough.
Right. Just that image of McMahon coming to your door is like,
it could be me.
Right.
Here, take all my other money. That would and mess me up for life, too. Yeah.
I remember kind of my first interaction with kind of trading was when I was a kid, actually. This is such a nerdy story, right? It's like most kids say, like, oh, I had my first, you know, like car or something. This is me, like, my first trade.
Your father was like standing over. He's like, I think my son is going to study economics and the neuroscience crosses.
Exactly. It's like, I really raised him to be a cool dude. So I remember thinking, this was, I think, like 2000 or so. So, like, when the first bubble was about to burst, that's when Carrie entered the market for the first time. And great timing. And so I bought this stock. It was just because I really liked the company. Like, I thought it had like a cool logo. And I was like, oh, I really know that this thing is going to really pop. And then
by the way, that's the way I do almost all my decisions.
Yeah.
Like horse race. I'm like,
name.
He never wins in mud. I'm like, but he's got a cool name and he's yellow.
Yeah. He's got cute socks on.
Right.
So I traded on that and then I lost all my money immediately. So I would say, like, now that is the type of thing, when I study it, it seems so irrational. But kind of knowing that I did that and kind of remembering the cognition that kind of generated that decision, to me, it makes me think that, you know, other people can certainly do this, and they do certainly do this. And
like, while it may be irrational, it makes sense
it
why
makes
people
total
feel
sense.
That irrational
right,
feeling.
Right,
because you went through it.
That's right.
So you're able to look at your behavior
so
patterns.
I can kind of, and I can kind of, I guess, empathize with other people that are doing. And so now I know that, like, I'm not going to be able to beat the market on my own, and so I just don't actively pick stocks
pursue,
like that.
Yeah, that's...
So that's one thing. And then maybe just more generally, you know, we were talking a little bit before about this, you know, curing this buy low, sell high bias by maybe reducing emotions. And I think over time I have reduced my emotions a little bit. And that may have just been a factor of being in school for 25 centuries.
It might have been a factor of evaluating analytics in decision theory.
Right.
Just numbed you to the core.
Yes, exactly. So my first week in California, if I had not gone to that class instead of going to the beach, maybe life would have been a little bit
if
different.
You just stopped swatting all of your decisions, or what is it called? Like the pros and cons thing?
Yeah, the cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, decision fatigue.
Yes, exactly.
So you briefly mentioned genetics before. Mm. Am I genetically predisposed to be terrible with money? But again, also, like, I'm sorry, like we said earlier, I think I'll turn this question into my own theory.
Yeah,
but,
please.
It's also environmental. Like, my wife's parents were not great with money in front of her. Mm-hmm. My parents were not good with money in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of emulated that behavior up until 7 months ago when I finally got out of credit card debt. And I was like, what have I been doing?
Yeah, so I definitely think genetics have a lot to do with it, but environment is also super important. But so actually the first project I worked on in this area was looking at which people are more adept at taking risk than others. And so what we did was we had a bunch of people come into a lab and just take a bunch of, you know, basically make bets on different gambles. And then afterward, I would give each person a little saliva tube where they would, you know, spit in a cup basically, and then send off this, you know, this data to get a genotype to see what was the gene kind of that they had.
Oh, wow.
And seeing whether the people that took more risk actually had this one particular gene. And we did find this idea that this one gene, MAOA, the certain low variants, those people were the ones that are actually taking more risk.
Wow. So, like, gambling could be in your genes or high-risk behavior when it comes to finances.
That's right.
What's going on in people's brains when they make financial decisions? Like, could you parallel, like, that's the stock experiment you did to making purchases too, or is it?
Yeah. I mean, they're both. I definitely think you can. So the idea is that, I mean, at least what the data suggests so far is that when you are looking to purchase something, what your brain will do is it will construct this value or your kind of subjective opinion of how valuable this thing is. And that signal will be in this kind of front area of your brain called the prefrontal cortex. And then this kind of guides the decision about whether you should buy it or not. So if we're buying, let's say, a shirt, you kind of assess what the price is. Let's say it's $40. And if this brain signal says that I value it at $60, then it's a worthwhile investment, right? Because I value it more than it costs. And so you generate this kind of surplus of $20.
Yeah, you're making money.
Yeah, you're kind of getting a deal.
Yeah. My mom has that to the nth degree, to the point where if she buys a bootleg movie and it costs $5,
right,
and me and my two brothers watch it, she like looks at it like it would have cost $48 for the three of them to go to the movies.
Yeah.
But I saved $43 by buying this bootleg. And I try to explain to her, I'm like, I wouldn't even have watched this bootleg if you didn't get it. Right. I wouldn't go see this movie in the theaters. And also, a theater experience is different. Like, it's not just a straight loss of money, but the fact that my mother has a son who works in entertainment and should not be buying bootleg films, notwithstanding. But she says that the guy at the nail salon has the best selection. So that's a completely different kind of economic system we're going to get into it with Joanne.
So that's kind of the first phase of the decision. Like when you're doing a fan, so you're going to kind of compute this value, which kind of guides your decision. And then once you make it, you're still going to look at whether the decision was good or not. So then you'll get some outcome and then you'll see this information. So suppose you bought the stock and then it goes up. That news or that information that's gone up is then going to register in your brain. And that will then create another signal of, let's say, you know, good job.
Yeah.
And that might reinforce you then to maybe purchase something again in the future.
That decision worked.
Yeah.
Now, when you say if you value the shirt at 60 and you pay 40 for it, could your want or your taste make that shirt more valuable? Like, you're like, oh, I really like these kinds of shirts. I value that even higher in my head. Like, I guess that's like value bias.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's a bias. I think everyone has their own taste. So, I mean, what's going to be constant across people is the price that the store is charging, right? That's the $40.
But right.
You might have a $60 valuation for that shirt, whereas I might have a $6,000 valuation
or a $20 valuation. Like, I would never wear something.
Right. Like that. Or, like, so, you know, if I went to the casino and literally lost my shirt, then I would really value that extremely highly.
By the way, this shirt comes in handy if we do these experiments back to back. You might want to hold on to that shirt.
It's like, all of a sudden, that is the most valuable shirt I've ever seen in my life.
Right. Oh, that's right, because it all depends. So I put on the shirt, I find that I look really good in it, and I get reinforced. Now, I know that I look good in this style of shirt. Mm-hmm. Now, the next time I see that shirt, is it worth $80? Like, could it be potentially, now it's worth more. I'm like, now I know those are good. And is that, now I'm just spitballing here, but is that why couples look at money being spent completely differently? Like, I spend $50 on marijuana or marijuana accessories, and my wife is like, that is a waste of money.
Yeah.
She spends like $200 on like high-end shampoos and conditioners. Yeah. I say, that is a waste of money.
Yeah.
We both look at them in different ways.
Yeah. You both just have your own kind of subjective tastes.
Yeah.
But
impossible not to have.
And I think that's, you know, it would be weird if everyone had exactly the same taste, right? Then we would be in this weird world where
it would be easy to figure out the market.
Exactly.
And all that stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. But I think, going back to your example about the shirt and it becoming more valuable once you bought it, there is actually a lot of evidence showing that it's not just because maybe you like it, but just because you own it, you might actually increase your valuation of it.
Right, because now it's yours.
So you bought it for 40, and let's say, you know, someone's willing to buy it from you for 45, you say, well, no, actually, I don't want that,
it's
because now all of a sudden I view it as like 80 or something like that.
Oh, cool.
So it can kind of change over time a little bit.
Oh, right. And then once you sold him, if you did sell your shirt for 45, you'd root for it
to go down.
To go down.
Exactly.
I hope that shirt sucks. I hope you spill something on it.
I hope it burns.
Day one. Yeah. I hope you get it caught in the car door and are dragged down a highway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up soon, Carrie. I'll let you get back to what I think. I understand what you're doing now.
Okay, good.
But I guess the last question, one of the last questions I'll ask is, this is a little esoteric, but can money buy happiness? Is that something you could technically study?
I mean, obviously there's the kind of, I think, easier answer, which is just, you buy stuff and that stuff makes you happy, but just yeah. the, you know, does money intrinsically make you happy without, you know, the kind of primary rewards or the food or whatever it is that you buy that you're able to make happy? And man, that's a hard question. I would say,
I mean, it is, it's literally like a philosophy question.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
So don't feel bad. You're like, oh, I'm racking my brain. Can money buy happiness? I'm like, oh, Carrie, it's okay if we don't answer it here.
Yeah.
To be
really
fair.
Really, really screwed up that last question on the podcast today.
Carrie, do you have like a field of study or a website that you would maybe want to promote or tell people to take your intro to economics class at USC? Or is there a place where people could read your research or
books?
Yeah,
I think my website is terribly long and I need to change that. So if you just Google Carrie Friedman USC, you should be able to see all my work there.
All right, cool. Google Carrie Friedman, Friedman at in USC, and check out some of the work that Carrie's doing here. And next time you're gambling, maybe think twice about how you feel after a decision.
That's right.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Wow. Thank you, Dr. Carrie Friedman. I really learned a lot about myself here. Unfortunately, I didn't think I wanted to know this, but I did learn that gambling and risk-taking is genetic. It doesn't mean I can't help myself and, you know, change the environment, the part that I can control. I also learned that value changes on context, why I'm okay with like throwing away hundreds of dollars, but bitch when an old fashioned costs 14 bucks. And it's rack bourbon. Come on, people. At least throw a little Woody Reserve in there for Uncle Gabrus. But most importantly, I'm grateful that there are scientists out there that are answering the questions that we want answered. For example, are we alone in the universe? What's the best way to brew an IPA? How come I keep betting the hard 10 on the craps table even though I know it's not a winner? Bet. Thank you to all the good scientists answering these very important life questions. Again, one more thanks to all my guests, Dr. Keith and Dr. Laura, Farah, and of course, Dr. Carrie Friedman. And of course, thanks to you, the listener. I hope you got something out of me getting something out of these people's somethings. Thanks again to my producer, Eric Martin. The Layman is a Howl original and a production of Midroll Media.